Welcome to the Security Serengeti. We're your hosts, David Swiniger and Matthew Keener. Stop what you're doing and subscribe to our podcast and leave us a five-star review and follow us at SerengetiSec on Twitter.
We're here to talk about some recent news headlines and hopefully provide some insight, analysis, and practical application that you can take into the office to help you protect your organization.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are ours and ours alone. Do not reflect the views or opinions of our employers.
Once Elon Musk gets his Neuralink in everyone's head, instead of ransoming school computers, attackers can ransom the school children.
Dun, dun, dun. Alrighty, so our first news article is IT biz Kaseya's VSA abused to infect business with ransomware. And this comes to us from the Register. So obviously everybody's talking about Kaseya this week. So the brief synopsis of what has occurred with Kaseya is their on-prem VSA product was attacked by the Reval ransomware gang and used to infect its customers and or the customers of those customers who were primarily MSPs. Kaseya has told their customers to turn off their on-premise devices. They took off their SaaS solution out of precaution. And right now, we don't know how many victims are affected. It's somewhere between 800 and 1,500, according to the FBI and the DHS CISA office. Kaseya themselves have 36,000 customers. And according to a thread on Reddit from Huntress, 30 MSPs were potentially involved. According to Kaseya, that I don't know if that 30% is necessarily indicative of this number, but they say 0.1% of their customers have been affected. And the big one there that everyone's hearing about is the Swedish grocery store chain, which is called Coop. And they had to shut down 500 of their stores.
It's a Coop or Co-op?
I've heard it on other things that I've listened to. I've heard them call it Coop.
Interesting.
I actually am not sure. Yeah. Usually co-op has a second O capitalized.
Yeah. Well, we'll just blame Swedish. We'll call it a Swedish. It's in Swedish.
Well, at least they didn't ransomware Swedish fish.
It's actually pronounced Coop.
Probably. At least it doesn't have one of those, what's the double dot umlaut or whatever?
Oh, God. Yeah, I have no
idea. As long as they don't put that thing in there, forget about it.
I'm just really upset Sweden can't get their meatballs.
I'm trying to think, is IKEA Swedish or Finnish? Or
Swedish.
Swedish. Oh, man. Well, at least their cafeterias are still open. Because they have they sell the bags of meatballs there. But Reval, obviously not wanting to be outdone by those puny numbers, have claimed that they got a million computers and are offering a bulk discount of $70 million in Bitcoin to release to the entire public a decryptor that would decrypt all the ransomware systems.
So who would pay that $70 million? Fall to a government, right? Because the companies are never going to get together and be like, I'll chip in $1 million here, 500,000 here.
That would be my guess, unless, I mean, that's the only thing I think of that would do it. Another possible scenario that seems much less likely is if they're targeting MSPs, it's possible that they have common insurance carriers, or maybe they're the affected customers are within a certain industry where they have common carriers and the insurance companies might pool to pay that $70 million. But that seems very, a very far-fetched idea.
How about we send $70 million worth of drones over to deliver their payment? I mean, that's like four drones, so.
I don't even think it's that many. You know, Predator or Global Hawk, I don't think is inexpensive.
They're only inexpensive in comparison to a F-35 or whatever the hell it is.
Oh yeah.
Look at this. A Predator system, which includes four drones, costs $64 million.
Oh,
And publicly traded defense company Kratos sells jet drones, which has stealth characteristics at $3 million a pop. That's a whole squadron or two.
Well, see, here's where you're missing. You're missing the thing that you could round that up with the missiles. You know, top it off at 70 million, up from 64 with the addition of a few missiles. And then you got the jet fuel, which is, you know, X amount.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think just one Predator system is probably right at that 70 million mark.
That makes sense. Got to pay somebody to fly it. That's probably the cheapest part of the system.
Oh, yeah. They pay those people with Twinkies or something. All right, so going over the basic scenario here. So this all happened due to a vulnerability in that VSA application. So back in April, the Dutch Institute for Vulnerability Disclosure discovered 7 vulnerabilities within the Kaseya VSA application. And they notified VSA of these vulnerabilities, and Kaseya began the process of doing remediation and of those 7. So in 2 releases, in version 9.5.5 and 9.5.6, they fixed 4 of those 7 vulnerabilities, which leaves 3 remaining vulnerabilities.
I'm actually really impressed that they got those 4 fixed that quickly. I mean, that 9.5.5 release you have on here in your notes, you put that it was released on the 10th of April. That's 4 days after it was reported.
Right.
I mean, they didn't get them all, but.
Well, they fixed, I think that was only one fix though in 4 days. Yeah, it took them another month to do 3 more.
Yeah, but still, like, most companies seem to really just sit on these forever. I wonder how
I heard a report somewhere, unfortunately, where I heard it eludes me at the moment, that when they notified VSA or Kaseya of the vulnerabilities, at least one of these had been seen being exploited already.
Ooh, all right, that's different.
That may have been that one vulnerability that was initially fixed.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'm curious as to why these overlap so closely. Like, why were they discovered and then less than 2 months later exploited? Is it, did the attackers just coincidentally find it?
I don't know. I'd actually have to look to see, because they discovered this stuff on the 6th of April, and Kaseya started fixing them. But I'd have to actually look to see when the CVEs were issued, because it's possible that someone was looking for this, trolling the CVE releases or something.
No, you know what? On June 26th, they started deploying the 9.57 patch, which resolved the credentials leak and business logic flaw. It was slated to be generally available on July 7th. But so it looks like the attackers got a hold of the patch and reverse engineered the patch, because this happened 6 days after the patch was started deploying.
Oh, that would make sense. Yep. So they reverse engineered it, was able to get what's interesting then is how quickly they were able to leverage that into this broad scope of an attack then.
Yeah, people have been doing this for years for the Windows patches. I mean, I've seen lots of, you know, Reddit threads or articles about the Windows patch, and then they'll, you know, point out exactly what was fixed in the patch through reverse engineering. But this may be the first time I've seen it for a third party thing like this.
Right. Hmm. So that makes me wonder about the attackers and how they're leveraging the CVE database. If they have like scripts that are looking for keywords or something like that, and just regularly checking the database and are spitting out CVEs that meet certain criteria, that would make sense, because then they wouldn't have to focus on a particular application. They can just focus on a particular class of vulnerability, which gives them the most bang for their buck.
That makes sense. If you've got specialized, you know, exploit writers who are really good at like cross-site scripting or something.
Right. Well, I mean, you figure if they know C or, you know, the common language that all applications are written in.
I see. Yeah.
Doesn't really matter. All right. So the ransomware itself seems to be pretty sophisticated because it involved code signing and a legitimate version of Windows Defender. And these things helped it avoid or evade many antivirus applications. So according to Kaspersky, the dropper was a PowerShell, which disabled Defender for endpoint, and then dropped an executable, which was an older version of Defender, and a malicious DLL file, which was the actual ransomware. And then they used DLL sideloading to actually load that DLL up and run it. And another thing that was noted by TrustWave was that it avoids encrypting files on systems that use Russian language or the other languages associated with the former Soviet Union.
So if you had followed that advice on Twitter from the other month about changing your keyboard language to Russian or whatever.
Yeah, from Krebs, wasn't it?
I don't remember where it was.
Yeah, I think we got that from Krebs.
Ridiculous. So no, I actually really like the way they did this, the DLL sideloading, where they drop the file and the DLL in the same folder, because that's how it works. So it checks the same folder first. That's smart. And I imagine that probably would not have been detected by a lot of tier one and two analysts. I feel like a lot of the analysts, since it used the legitimate executable, they would have grabbed that version. They would have stuck that up and they'd be like, oh, that's weird. This looks like the normal executable.
Right. They would check the executable, but not necessarily the DLL.
Right, right.
And say, well, if the executable is legit, then the DLL is most likely legit.
Because I'll be honest, DLL sideloading is not something that I've seen that often. And although I do notice that it also agent.exe was a malicious executable, so they may find that and get rid of that and then think that they're fine.
Like kind of a, not exactly a bait and switch or maybe a red herring kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah, that's interesting.
So Kaseya had responded to this on the 5th, and there I'm sorry, the 2nd, and their first update said they're in the process of investigating it, and they've notified all their on-premise customers and told them to shut down their VSA servers, and they had not heard of any reports of compromise of their SaaS solution. Their SaaS customers, but they shut down their SaaS solution as a precaution. And since then, they've been doing multiple updates a day, including some video updates, which is, I think, kind of, it's almost becoming the norm for this kind of updating to take place now from organizations that have been hit with something this serious and broad reaching. So it's kind of interesting where in the past, if someone was hit with something like that, it'd almost be radio silence. And now more organizations are taking the posture of, we need to be as open and provide as many updates as frequently as we can to the entire community. Because it's not just to their customers. They're posting this stuff up on their site for anybody to access. So this isn't even private notification to their customers either.
Yeah, I wonder how many, they said they have 36,000 customers. I wonder how many of those customers are MSPs and how many of them that, you know, could therefore compromise multiple other companies or.
I don't know.
So, cause they did shut down really fast. I think they only 30 potentially MSPs were affected and some number of other customers, given that they had 36,000, or maybe the attackers were just really slow in the way they moved through this, but I feel like they responded pretty quickly.
Well, one of the things that allows attack like this to be successful is attackers have to be able to get access to the VSA appliance in the first place. So you'd have to get an idea about how many of those appliances were internet facing to begin with, and then scale from there.
Well, obviously you make it internet facing. How else are you supposed to log in and fix things while you're relaxing on the beach?
Yeah, you certainly wouldn't want to use a VPN or anything like that.
That's not necessary. Yeah, we use two-factor. Actually, their two-factor bypass wasn't involved in this, so I guess I shouldn't call that out.
Oh, although that was one of the three vulnerabilities that hadn't been patched yet.
Yeah, so I guess using two-factor would not have potentially prevented this. Although I don't know if they exploited that at all. I don't think there was any indications of it.
Well, I think it was Kaspersky. Maybe they said that the exploit involved an authentication bypass, arbitrary file upload, and command injection flaws. So I'm not sure. I guess that's kind of open to interpretation. But of course, Kaseya got a hold of FireEye and Mandiant, as well as other security firms to help them out.
I almost feel bad for other incident response firms. Like, nobody ever calls them. They're just sitting around. They just want to help.
You know, what's interesting is a lot of the large vendors that I've dealt with in the past, almost all of them offer incident response retainers.
Mm-hmm.
But at this point, I think Mandiant and FireEye are really going on name recognition.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not to disparage them or anything, but I'm not certain that they're so much better than everyone else in this area that they should be the only ones you call.
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, and obviously they aren't the only ones that get called either. Otherwise, we wouldn't have the Verizon breach report every year.
Mm-hmm.
Because hundreds of people, if not thousands, call Verizon for help as well. But also, Kaseya published some stuff for their customers themselves to provide advice to them. So they published a run book of the changes they should make to their on-premise environment in preparation for when they bring those systems back online, which may be Sunday the 11th. They had posted that they expect on the 11th at 4 p.m. they will be releasing the patch. Now, just because they release the patch, though, if the attackers have gotten in, they may or probably have installed their own backdoors already. So simply patching a system doesn't necessarily mean that those systems should be brought back online, because the existing backdoor may then just come up for the attackers to be able to leverage. So they'd have to make sure that those systems are thoroughly clean before they bring them back up. And Kaseya also, in an attempt to help their customers, created a compromise detection tool to look for IOCs.
Now, that probably is pretty effective in this case. Given that the attackers were almost certainly attacking programmatically, the IOCs should be very similar each time versus, you know, it's like 10 different attackers and they're all doing slightly different things. In this case, I think it's probably a given that the IOCs that are one company will be IOCs in another company that's compromised.
Yeah, I think the dead giveaway for that one is the offer to do an offer of taking the 70 million and mm-hmm. doing a bulk decrypt.
Yeah, it's all the same software.
Yeah, so it would really have to be for that to work.
But that seems like that's probably the next step in the evolution of these kinds of attacks, is to use like rotating software that uses a slightly different registry key and, you know, shifts its hash and changes the decryption keys and all that.
Yeah, I don't think that would be too far of a stretch, really.
Most malware does it now, so.
Yeah, but if you consider it like the way that Apple does iOS patches and upgrades. So when your iPhone gets an up, you know, it has a patch available or an upgrade available. If you watch it when it goes through the process of doing an upgrade, it talks about contacting them, getting the download, and then preparing to do the install. And all that takes a little bit of time, because the installer for your iPhone is actually unique to your phone. Hmm. You could not take that same downloaded install and install it on anybody else's phone because it's cryptographically tied to your individual device. So they could do something similar as well for all the ransomware and the encrypted files. And as seen by, you know, this, the way that they're doing this alone, these guys are not unskilled coders or developers. They're quite good at what they do. And then, of course, the U.S. government weighed in, and the CIS and FBI provided guides, MSPs and Kaseya victims as well, suggesting that they download that detection tool that we mentioned a moment ago, enable multi-factor authentication, implement allow listing to limit the communications, and place the administrative interfaces behind a VPN or a firewall. And really, all these recommendations would be sound advice before the event even happened, with the exception of the first one about the detection tool.
Yeah, I'm not sure how these would stop it, honestly. Like, all right, so the multi-factor authentication, especially if you're using an MSP to handle it. And there was a two-factor bypass that was available. Again, it doesn't look like they used it, but in this case, there happened to be one. I guess actually the known IP address pairs would help at the MSP level to prevent the attackers from logging in.
Well, it would prevent them from being able to launch the attack in the first place.
Well, that's what I mean, for them logging into the Kaseya appliance. Because once they're in the appliance, or once they're in the SaaS cloud, like then that doesn't matter what the end people do.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter what the end customers do.
Well, it's probably an assumption that they've got they've compromised accounts. So if they're not able to get to the interface anymore, it would prevent those compromised accounts from being able to be leveraged.
That's fair. Yeah, they'd have to like fish the place first and then pivot over to the Kaseya.
Mm-hmm. Well, if they can't get to the interface, then they'd have to compromise an internal system and then pivot, if that's what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder if that's what attackers will go for next then. Now that they've seen kind of the power of this SolarWinds and this Kaseya style attack, if we're going to see MSPs and or, you know, people that supply MSPs with software or run the cloud fall under a heavier attack as they try and do that pivot. And then, because once they have those legitimate credentials, then they don't need any vulnerabilities in Kaseya. Like if they can compromise an admin user on Kaseya's account and then pivot over into the cloud and then push it out, it almost seems easier than exploiting these vulnerabilities.
Oh, yeah. That's a good point. And MSPs probably aren't any more, I don't know what the proper word for it is, diligent or stringent password requirements or password hygiene than other places.
And they almost certainly have shared passwords between all their customers.
I think that's almost a guarantee.
How else can you pivot from one customer to the next easily? You're just going to run into failed password after failed password. Who can remember all these passwords?
And one would hope they're leveraging a password manager too versus an Access database or an Excel spreadsheet.
Spreadsheet on their desktop.
Well, on their desktops or on their file share. Because everybody's got to be able to get to it.
No, you're right. And you got to synchronize it, because if you just had a separate copy on everybody's computer, you know, it'll go out of date real fast.
Yep. So, yeah.
Yeah, they probably just email it out to everybody.
Yeah, they probably do both. But the problem is that the email copy would get out of sync with the file share copy. So if you're going to attack an organization and you get that spreadsheet out of the email, just know it may be out of date. All right. And it's interesting that shortly before this even happened, the UK decided that they were going to, and this is something that's basically been sent out for public comment, that they're going to come up with a proposed framework for managed security service providers and in order for them to implement a adequate baseline of security.
What is an adequate baseline of security?
Depends on who you ask, obviously.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess some frameworks and some things like, what's the stupid credit card one?
PCI?
PCI. I mean, that's been somewhat successful at increasing the, you know, base level of people online.
Well, the problem is that it's always a moving target. Even if you were to reach a baseline, within a week, you're probably out of compliance because the entire environment is always changing. New system being brought online, new services, and so on and so forth. Because you can't maintain something in a dynamic environment If because you can only really do that as a point in time call, that yeah, you're compliant now, which is why whenever you look at an organization that has adopted PCI, they will get their ROC and then they'll almost immediately be out of compliance, and the PCI folks will say, oh, well, they weren't really PCI compliant at the time of their compromise, even though they got their ROC, which says they're basically essentially PCI certified. All right. And, you know, we mentioned a moment ago that Kaseya released that, that IOC, detection tool. Well, that did not go unnoticed by attackers, and other attackers started spam campaigns leveraging the news of Kaseya patches to deliver malware to other people via a link or an attached executable to compromise other people's systems with Cobalt Strike.
Nice. Do they have no honor taking advantage of our crises?
And you got to strike while the iron's hot.
Yeah, I also saw where I learned about this on Friday was there's a Reddit thread for crowdsourcing information that was started by Huntress, who's a managed endpoint security provider. What is it's not MSP, it's MDR, managed detection and response. This was actually a super useful thread. It's got IOCs in there that were being crowdsourced and people were reporting. It talks about the agent.crt and screenshot.jpg. It's got the PowerShell script that run to disable real-time monitoring, disable AV protection, disable script scanning, all that. And it's got the cert util command in there to download the agent.crt. It's a super informative thread. I would love to see something like this in all of these. And maybe it's existed in the past, I've just never seen it before.
Right. I mean, if that was a standard going forward, that could be really helpful for, you know, any situation, really.
Yeah, because that's always one of the things, it's always one of the big issues when these things happen, is every company stays in its own silo. They try to respond by themselves. They're waiting for, you know, official word of what's going on. And most places have kind of those unofficial back channels where they can reach out to other people. But I like having it out in public this way.
I think it's also handy if everybody really kind of jumps on board with leveraging Reddit, because then you've got a single point. You may get IOCs from here or there, or, you know, Talos or any number of other security firms or teams. But as long as it's centralized on a Reddit thread, then you don't have to go hunting or seeking that out at all these different other security sources.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole reason that even if you're not affected by this this event, that we should sit up and take notice of this is that a lot of the companies that got compromised in this were just small companies being managed via an MSP. So even if you or your company, you're like, well, we're tiny and we don't have anything of value really, does not mean that you are not, I wouldn't say necessarily on someone's radar, but cannot potentially fall victim of a ransomware attack, even if you're not directly targeted. And I kind of think this is like, I don't want to call it SolarWinds 2.0, but I think this is like the next volley in this SolarWinds supply chain attack world that we live in now. So before, you know, SolarWinds really happened, you'd hear a lot of attacks against operating systems or standard internet facing web services, browsers and their plugins, Office Suites, you know, that kind of thing. I won't exactly call them low hanging fruit, but kind of, you know, common applications that everyone is kind of aware of, where SolarWinds, I know people have said SolarWinds is not a household name, but if you work in IT, there's no one that has not heard of SolarWinds. I mean, they had on their website listed that they had 300,000 customers, but they weren't a household word for, or a household name for all the normal people out there.
Ah.
You know, what IT people call normies. So I think this Kaseya kind of Solar Winds open the attacker's eyes to this, and then Kaseya is like the next iteration of that. And I think that we're going to see attackers changing exactly, not necessarily the scope, but what they are thinking about when they're looking for vulnerabilities or software that they want to look into. If they're going to actually discover the vulnerabilities themselves, what software they're going to target for that. We mentioned a little bit ago that they may have scripts running to monitor CVEs for certain types of vulnerabilities. But as far as the software types themselves, I think this is kind of also almost a new category where they're going to be looking for software attributes versus like software names or companies. So, and this is just kind of a list that I put together of what these types of software may have in common. So, software with agents that run with elevated privileges that are installed on most systems or high value systems, applications that have broad network access that require an internet connection and or managed from a cloud provider, or a software suite that has a niche. It's primarily used by a certain industry, MSPs or insurance companies or something along those lines. And maybe looking at software that is primarily used in organizations that are medium sized. Small companies, they don't really have a lot of money to pay and are probably not insured. And large companies, they have more IT and more security resources to mitigate those kinds of attacks. And another possible attribute would be that the software has a virtual monopoly in a certain aspect of IT, kind of like SolarWinds. They weren't commonly known by a lot of people, but with 300,000 customers, if you were talking about doing IT monitoring, they weren't a monopoly per se, but they had a huge reach within lots and lots of organizations, and as well as software that's actually expected to perform installs.
Yeah, because that's got to have admin rights. If the tool you're targeting has admin rights everywhere, it does most of the work for you.
And if it's installing malware, it looks like it's doing what it's supposed to be doing, which is installing software.
Mm-hmm.
The last possible attribute of attribute that I was thinking of was software that's installed by companies but is designed to be managed by a separate company.
Yeah, again, because if you can, why hack 25 companies when you can hack one? It's all about efficiency.
It's economies of scale.
Yeah. And that goes on to the point that you pulled out of the Lawfare article, which I thought was super interesting. It'll be linked in the show notes, of course. But using that centralization creates problems of scale, where it used to be a gang can only hack one company at a time. They only have so many criminals that are willing to do these things. But when you break in any kind of these points of centralization, you're getting all of the edges that the central core touches to fail all at once or in very short order. And that's a great way to overwhelm a defensive system. Not that these companies are connected, but the FBI is getting all these calls, Bandiant's getting all these calls. We're reaching out to all of our IR providers and our third party security MSSPs, and they're all kind of getting involved in hitting these too when hundreds of companies are hit.
When there's also like a secondary effect of now everybody has to go and look. Because everyone is like, are we affected? And depending on the size of your organization, that may take you a little while to figure out. All right. So finally, what should you do about this? So one thing I would do is consider that list that I just provided above and see what applications you have within your environment that fall into those kinds of categories. And depending on what attribute the software which you have falls into those, consider what risk reduction efforts you can apply based on that type of attribute or that risk.
Yeah. And if one thing that came to mind for myself is risk assessment processes. I'm sure that, of course, every company, before you brought in a third party like an MSP to help take care of your IT infrastructure, you, of course, had a risk assessment on them. One of the things you may want to do is you may want to look at tiering your risk assessments. Different vendors coming in will have different risk profiles and maybe deserve a different level of scrutiny on how much based on how much damage they can do to you if things go down. This is, you know, just the latest in a long and illustrious history of third parties causing data breaches, starting, you know, with Target back in the day.
Right. And when you're doing these kind of risk assessments, if you're doing the risk assessment on an MSP, you should probably have a good understanding about how their processes work. You know, is the application that they're going to use to manage your environment, are they putting those boxes on the internet? You know, are they following good practices in securing their own network, yeah, as well as following good practices in order to manage the credentials that they're using to access your network? And is that the same credential that's being used to access other companies' networks?
Ask them for their pen test results.
All right. So what we discussed here is contained in a lot of articles, which will all be in the show notes.
So many articles.
Like a lot of articles.
Yeah. My favorite though was the Lawfare blog one. Definitely check that one out. Do you have a favorite one?
UK government publication.
Really?
No, I'm kidding. I did not have one, but I always like, we don't even have a register one in here. Usually the register has something cheeky to say.
I'm sure.
Oh, no, that too. Is the first one.
That's the first one?
Yeah.
That's the first one?
So it would have to be the register, because they always have some backhanded comments to make, which are amusing.
Yeah, I don't know which one we looked at. One of the articles we were looking at, I read out the headline. You're like, oh, that's the register. Yep, it was.
Yeah.
All right. For our second article, this is actually kind of a follow-up to an article we were talking about a couple of weeks ago on legal privilege. I had some questions after the last article on legal privilege, because I'd always kind of heard, you know, oh, well, if you CC a lawyer, that's good enough. That provides legal privilege. You know, they can't discover it. It's shielded from, you know, any kind of lawsuit or anything like that. But according to this article, that is not quite enough. So a quick summary. When an organization faces a cybersecurity incident, taking appropriate steps to preserve the attorney-client privilege and work product protection is critical. Pretty sure that's copied directly from the article.
It is.
So, but the high level here is that attorney-client privilege is not quite as simple as just copying and CCing a lawyer. The big thing that they call out here is that it cannot be used for ordinary business reasons. And I'm gonna quote the article again. You must demonstrate that the purpose is for legal advice or made in anticipation of litigation. So just including a lawyer on an email while you're conducting your day-to-day business does not meet those guidelines. So in order to help you meet those guidelines and be able to demonstrate that the purpose was for legal advice or in anticipation of litigation, they provided 8 wonderful steps to help you out there. Again, all of them really come back down to making it not ordinary business reasons. So the first one is involve counsel all the way at the beginning. And this is a second article that says that legal should lead and supervise the incident response.
To quote the article, every aspect of a breach investigation.
Yeah, not just you know, leading the legal stuff or the advisory stuff or the, you know, GDPR stuff, but I don't know, man. That actually kind of, to me, goes against the ordinary business reasons, because if counsel is leading and supervising every aspect of the investigation, then it becomes ordinary business, right?
That's a good question, because it certainly sounds like it.
Yeah. So they did one of their sub things here, they said, was they recommended retaining outside counsel because in some countries, privilege only applies to outside counsel. And again, that also makes sense with the not ordinary business, because if you're using your in-house counsel for it, well, I mean, they're hired for ordinary business, right? So that's something to think about. The next one they recommend is that counsel should retain the third parties, such as your forensic investigators, you know, your Mandiant or whatever, and make sure that the retainer agreement states that the third party is being retained to provide legal advice in anticipation of litigation, so that you can point to that when they do the discovery and say, oh, no, again, not ordinary business, anticipation of litigation, legal advice. Boom. Those are the things you need to be hitting. Again, in relation to the not ordinary business, have a separate vendor for breach response. Don't use the companies that you do the routine work from. Don't use your audit company. Don't use your MSSP. Bring in a separate firm. Again, trying to dodge that ordinary business.
Yeah, you could even bring in Mandiant.
Yeah. Yeah, they don't do anything else now. They're getting rid of the FireEye part, right? Next, treat legal fees as a legal expense. It becomes harder to argue that it was for legal advice if it's coming out of the cybersecurity or IT budget. So that's interesting. That's a change you'd have to do probably years in advance, because I know budgets are always done at kind of in advance.
Yeah, at least a year.
Yeah.
Because you're going to go through a budget cycle. Mm-hmm. And you know, one thing that is probably going to bother some people with that kind of change would be that means that money that was previously in the IT security budget or in the IT budget is being removed and placed in the legal budget. Depending on the size of that could lead to some consternation.
Yeah, and that's interesting too, because you don't have a breach every year. Like, you can't set your watch to it. Like, oh, look, it's May. We're about to get some ransomware.
Right. Well, so that, you know, something else to do with that, though, it's interesting that just came to mind. Talking to a company not long ago that was saying, hey, you should go and get a breach retainer with us. And they were saying that, unlike other organizations, if you fail to leverage that breach retainer, you can then use that money for other things at the end of the year.
Yeah, training and like, why can't I think of the name of it? The exercise where you go through walk through your incident response plan, tabletops.
Right, tabletop?
Yeah, tabletops and training and stuff like that.
Right.
You need to get your lawyers trained up so they can lead the IR.
That would be a good idea.
Yep. So I'm not going to list all eight, but another one that was really interesting was consider whether you need to write an after action report. That's kind of considered standard, is that when you're done with an investigation from an incident, you write up the results and you work through what could we have done differently and whose fault is this and how do we fix it? Maybe not whose fault is it, we try not, but you know, like, how did this happen? What was the root cause? And this mentions that is going to be a primary target in any kind of legal discovery process. So the report, they recommend that the report avoid business matters and include conclusions and legal opinions from the counsel. So again, you can call it legal advice or being prepared for the purpose of anticipated litigation. I'm just going to repeat those over and over again, because really that's the thing. And a big items here is making sure that you don't do supposition. You don't speculate, because again, those might be misconstrued after the fact when someone's reading your emails, you know, 2 years later in the middle of a courtroom. It'd be awful if somebody wrote an email something like, I wonder if they got onto the domain controller, and then like you closed out the investigation. It turns out they did get on the domain controller. Anyways, it's definitely worth a good read.
And this was also written by a lawyer.
I mean, of course.
So even though, you know, Matt did not say at a Holiday Inn Express again, you don't have to take his advice or consider this advice directly from him.
So, okay. So really, what should you do about this and why does this matter? Number one is always the preparation. Talk to your legal team now. Don't do it when the incident occurs. Do it now, especially for things like the budget and for hiring third-party firms and retainers. That is something you need to get your ducks in order before the incident actually occurs. Number two, include legal in your exercises, especially if they may have to lead them. I still don't know how I feel about that one. I don't agree with it. And finally, like I said, look at those. I already mentioned this, but make sure you figure out which items need to be arranged ahead of time, what retainers need to be put in place, what third parties you need to already have a relationship with, and
what budget you need to move around. What
budget you may need to move around. Yep.
Well, that's all we have for the articles for today. Thank you for joining us, and follow us at Serengeti Sec on Twitter and subscribe on your favorite podcast app. And keep your head up and your spear sharp.